Today's episode comes from Series 2 with Alan Pacey. In this episode, Sean and I discuss with Alan the evolution of mouth fertility treatment, what actually happens behind the scenes in those labs, and what the future holds. It was not only a fun episode to record, it was also incredibly informative. So, if you're new to treatment, or just looking for a bit of clarification, this episode's for you. Enjoy. Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast, a podcast designed to help, support, and educate men as they go through their own fertility struggles. I'm Kieran.
And I'm Sean. And we'll do that by sharing our stories of what we went through, as well as having guests share their knowledge and experience. Right, let's get into today's episode.
Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. Today, Sean and I are joined by Professor of Andrology, Alan Pacey. Alan is the Deputy Vice President and Deputy Dean of Faculty of Biology, Medicine and Health at the University of Manchester. Prior to this position, he was Head of Andrology for Sheffield Teaching Hospitals for 17 years, where he ran the Andrology Laboratory and Sperm Bank. He has published over 250 research papers, book chapters and review articles. He is a former secretary and chairman of the British Fertility Society and is a current member of the Fertility Guideline Development Group for the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence. On top of his many accolades, in 2016, Alan received an MBE from Queen Elizabeth II for services to reproductive medicine. This is the Male Fertility Podcast. Welcome to episode 9 with Alan Pacey. Welcome, Alan. Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. It's great to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Thank you.
As we said before we started recording, we really appreciate you coming on. We know you're a busy guy, and our listeners will get a lot from hearing your knowledge and experience. So I suppose we better start talking about the history maybe of male fertility and treatment. An understanding of male fertility and the knowledge that has developed maybe over the last decade. How much change have you seen in, say, the last decade and are progressing into the future?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting the way you phrase that question because, you know, when I look back to, I guess I started in all seriousness in the 90s, early 90s. And that was about the time the Human Fertilization and Embryology Authority were first establishing themselves. And actually, they were pretty revolutionary in that they kind of mentioned the man in guidance and code of practice. And up until that point, I think the kind of service and the attention that a man got really depended on where he was and the interest of the team. So I always say, if you're an infertile woman or subfertile woman, you go and see your gynecologist. If you're a subfertile man, who do you go and see? You usually go and see your partner's gynecologist if you have one. I mean, if you're a single man or a gay man, I don't know where you would go. I think the GP would just look at you a bit bizarre still. So we've way to go. Yeah. But I think we have started to see the man more as a partner in this whole endeavor. But not every man gets the same level of service that you might get in a tertiary hospital that is interested in the topic. Yeah. I think we've got way to go to get GPs on board still. And I think we've still got stuff that we can do in the diagnostic arena. So we think about the main diagnostic test, semen analysis, was kind of devised in the early 1950s, and we still do it in the 1950s way. Now, the advantage is that it's cheap. It's relatively straightforward. Most men know how to masturbate. Most people know how to count sperm. So it kind of works, but it only gives you a certain level of information. And it's only more recently that we've got better genetic tests for things like Y chromosome deletions, or we've got tests for other things that we think are important, like cystic fibrosis screening, which can be important in some men. But we can do better than that. And there's a lot of research activity going on trying to develop new and better tests that might either predict the best sperm to use or might give the subfertile man a bit more information to be able to make choices. I think one of the big revolutions has been in home sperm testing, actually, in the last few years. Who would have thought that you could, for example, test your own semen in the privacy of your own home using a mobile phone and an app that you download from the internet. I mean, it's only going to get bigger and better from there. And I wish to some extent I was starting again, because I think I'd like to be on this revolution rather than be somebody who's retiring when it all kicks off.
Mm. Yeah, we are very pleased actually that one of our sponsors is Xseed, who provide one of those at-home tests. And that's what it's all about for, like, as two guys who have been through it. One of the most daunting things, and we dedicated a whole episode to it in our first series, just Kieran and I talking about that daunting thing of going in to provide a sample. And we've both had occasions, Kieran probably more comically than me, where we've gone in and not managed to produce for a factor of varying factors, but because there is so much riding on it. And if you can get that kind of initial idea of where you're at home, in the comfort of your own home, that's powerful. And like you said, you know, I wish that I was in this phase now where I could have started off, because that, you know, one of the most life-changing days of my life was when I got diagnosed with azoospermia, and to at least have had a test to kind of go, this doesn't look right, and then go from there, at least it would have softened the blow somewhat, maybe. But
I think you're right. I mean, knowledge is power, they say, and I'm all for that kind of knowledge. I mean, I'm a type 2 diabetic, and knowledge about kind of what's going on with me and my blood sugar is actually immensely helpful. So I can only imagine that as a guy, I think if I was a guy with fertility problems, I would equally want to kind of have that information. But the very fact that we're talking about it, you know, I remember back in the early 90s when it was a real embarrassment for guys to come in and provide a sample. We weren't very good at providing the facilities. We didn't really think about the man in that kind of a way. And locally, I hope I changed people's thinking about that. I remember when we moved to the new hospital in Sheffield in 2001 and we were kind of prepping to move into the hospital, I kind of looked at the plans and I said, where are the sperm production rooms? And I remember the architect going, what? And I said, the sperm production rooms. And he said, what do you want those for? So I then had to give a lesson about what we were about. And he said, men in a women's hospital, you must be balmy. Now, thankfully, we're having better quality conversations and the discipline is recognized. But they're just two silly examples of how poor it was in the early days and how much better we've got.
Yeah, I've certainly had my fair share of just sample rooms.
Oh yeah, there's a whole book in that, I'm sure.
You know, I've had some quite good, how can we say, resourced ones, and others where you're literally, I could hear people smoking and chatting outside, and, you know, and these extra pressures that are on a man just make it that little bit more difficult, doesn't it?
It does. And I think getting the room right actually has the potential to impact on the quality as well, whether it's a diagnostic specimen or a specimen that is going to be used in treatment. So I did a study with the people from Cryos, and a very simple study. Cryos invested in these VR headsets so that the erotic material was coming through the VR headset as opposed to looking at a two-dimensional screen. And when we analyzed the results, we could see a difference with the guys who'd masturbated with one of these VR headsets. And for those guys that had a short abstinence time, their semen quality was better. And I think that illustrates the concept that the room and the environment thereof can have an impact on the number of sperm that are released at ejaculation.
Yeah, I was going to, because that thought just came to my head in terms of actually when you're producing the sample, can the level of stress that you're under at that time affect the sample that you give, even if you went into that room calm and relaxed within those few minutes? Obviously what happens in your body is the hormones that are produced. Can that directly impact what goes into the pot?
I think it's not hormones and it's not stress, it's more arousal.
Right.
So there's evidence to show that if you are more sexually aroused, and that the mechanism by which that is achieved will be different for each individual man. But if the level of stimulation in your brain visually, or because your partner's around, for example, is optimal for you, then there's evidence, and there's good evolutionary theory to back this up, there's evidence that the number of sperm released can alter.
So if you're
going into a room, you're really stressed, you can hear noising outside, the magazines are a bit rubbish, and you want to get it done and dusted as quickly as possible, I can imagine that the sperm quality is not as good as if you're relaxed, you're a bit more aroused, and so on and so forth. And that's why I think home testing is important, because I think the level of kind of sexual arousal that you would get in home environment is going to be very different from what you get in a hospital environment. And that's why one other reason why I think these home sperm testing devices have a good use.
Definitely. And the first thing I'll be doing after this episode is buying a VR headset.
It's really weird when you watch the VR headset and you watch erotic material on them.
Really?
I've looked at it. It was a very weird experience.
So purely for research purposes.
Oh, research purposes only. Absolutely. Yeah. I did it in a room with lots of people watching me do it, and I was just really red. And when I took the headset off, they were all looking for my reaction.
See, that would be my concern, that I'd do what I need to do and then take it off and so I'd be stood there watching. But hey, that's why we have locks on doors and things. But when we started working with Xseed, they sent me a home sample, and I remember thinking, like, I wish I'd had this. Like this, like as Sean said, it would have lessened the blow, or at least given me an idea that it wasn't going to completely come out of the dark and take my feet. Because that's what happened. I had no idea about my poor sperm quality. So I can definitely see it being a powerful tool in the future.
Yeah, I think so. And I think what we have to get right as well is just make sure that there's sufficient support available at 11 o'clock at night when you decide that you want to do it and you go, and you need somebody to talk to. So, you know, the support services that wrap around that, I think, are just as important, because I don't know whether you have the NHS app now, but you're on your NHS app, you can see your test results before you get to your GP.
Yeah. And
I do cheekily look at my diabetic results, for example. So by the time I get to my GP for the discussion, I already know the answer. But imagine if that was a really bad result. Yeah. You would want to make sure that, you know, you had someone to phone, or that you were prepared for that result, because not all results are going to be what you want.
Yeah, and I think that's such a good point, because, people might not necessarily be doing it in office hours. So definitely. I found that what you mentioned about the arousal so interesting, and I've never heard that before, because one thing that we do get told all the time, like, kind of whether you're consuming stuff through social media or online, about when it comes to male fertility, is lifestyle, diet, and even environmental factors, all stuff that you can, that's more of, like, you know, the long-term effect on the sperm regeneration cycle, and it's one of the first things that you're kind of told when you step foot through the fertility door, is your initial kind of consults will be all based around what it is that you're doing. So what are the kind of big hitters when it comes to things like diet, lifestyle, environmental factors that are having an impact on male fertility?
Yeah, it's a really good question. It's a very common question, I think, because what we do in our lifestyle, everybody has a lifestyle. And we all make choices about food and exercise and so on and so forth, and smoking, drinking, that kind of thing. I think the important thing is to recognize that you have to consider lifestyle on top of everything else that's going on. So how many sperm a man will produce per unit time is dependent upon how big his testicles are, which in turn is dependent upon how he was put together as a human being when he was in mummy's womb, and all of the choices that he's made up until that point during puberty and so on and so forth. So a man with large testicles, arguably lifestyle is going to have less effect, in my opinion, than a man with small testicles, where the effect could be greater. Or, you know, one cigarette could be greater, for example. The other thing to think about is medical history. So we've all got medical history, and some things in the medical history will be okay. Some things will have had a detrimental effect, and one of those detrimental effects might be mumps. If you had mumps as an adult, that can damage the way testicles work, or chemotherapy treatment because of cancer treatment, that can have quite a dramatic effect on how the testicles function, and then we get to kind of like current illnesses and infections, and your kind of health goes up and down like this, and then on top of that we've got our lifestyle. So I think we need to think about putting things in context sometimes, and the effect of lifestyle will vary according to the man's medical history and all those other things that I mentioned. Now, the things that we worry about are fairly obvious. There's no surprises there. So things like smoking. I mean, we know that smoking is bad for lots of reasons. But what smoking seems to do, it doesn't stop the number of sperm that are produced, but it means that those sperm coming off the production line are a bit more damaged genetically. So stopping smoking is important. Alcohol consumption, mixed reports on that. If you are a moderate alcohol drinker and it's kind of within guidelines, you know, a beer on an evening, I don't think is anything to worry about. But 10 or 15 pints on a Friday night is more something to worry about because you're ingesting all of that alcohol in a big lot and the body finds that difficult to cope with. Then we have things that some people don't think about. So, you know, guys that go to the gym, take anabolic steroids, they look great, but actually it has a negative impact on their testicles and it stops the key hormones being released from the brain that tells the testicles to produce sperm. And actually the testicles shrink with guys that take steroids for a long time. Exercise, mixed reports, really. I think the evidence is a bit of exercise is always good, can reduce free radicals and it can help your body to kind of reduce toxins and so on and so forth. We're not expecting people to be a triathlete, but, you know, doing a bit more is always good for lots of things. BMI is a concern. So if you're on the heavy side, just losing a bit of weight may make all the difference. But if you are on the heavy side, it changes the hormone balance. Diet. Everybody's interested in diet. And the evidence is that if you are a pizza, burger, sausage eating guy with no fruit and veg, your sperm is generally worse than a fish, salad, fresh fruit and veg. And we know that. We all, you know, everybody knows that the kind of the Mediterranean diet is good for you. But there is evidence there that people on the Mediterranean diet generally have better sperm. Now, the individual impact of all of those, I think, is very difficult to kind of distill. And I think one of the dangers is that when doctors get a bit finger wagging, don't do this, don't do that, it can make for an unhappy life. You know, what do you want to do? Live in a hole and eat rain and drink rainwater and not do anything? Well, that was not going to be a pleasant life, is it? So get things in context. I think the no-nos have to be smoking and the steroids. The rest is a blend. And the key is that if you change your lifestyle on Friday, your sperm won't have improved by Monday. But if you change your lifestyle in January, you might see an improvement by March because it takes about 3 months to produce a sperm from start to finish. So, you know, a consistent, healthy lifestyle, cutting out things that we think are bad, can make a bit of a difference. It may not change the numbers, but it may change the quality and the health of those sperm. The one I didn't mention was underwear. I did a study 10, 15 years ago, 2,500 men in the UK, didn't expect it. When we analyzed the result, tight pants were bad. And it's because of the heat that's generated when your testicles are lifted up toward the body. So one of the most simplest pieces of advice I would give to anyone is boxers. And that applies to skinny jeans as well. I mean, I think if you're wearing skinny jeans, I don't think you're in fashion anymore now, but you know, when the skinny jeans were in fashion, they would have the same effect of tight pants. So, you know, don't bother with all this fancy stuff off the internet that costs a fortune. Good solid pair of boxers from Marks's or Sainsbury's or Tesco or whatever, or the retailers are available, will actually mean that your testicles are at the right temperature to produce sperm. And that's a really good piece of advice, I think.
Yeah, it's all amazing advice. What I kind of took from that is anything that's generally good for your health in general is good for your fertility health. Indeed. As well. Indeed. I think, I mean, I've definitely been in that rabbit hole where you think you're a rabbit in headlights thinking, where do I start? But actually, if you make those changes in small increments, it's a lot more easier to handle. And it's really not rocket science. I think a lot of people overcomplicate it. You know, move more, eat a bit, or eat better, get some good sleep. Don't put anything in your body you shouldn't really.
Yeah.
And if you stick to those rules, you're going to be in a better place than you were 3 months ago. And the consistency is key. I think that's something that, you know, especially talking to, you know, my own PT clients, it's hammering home, be consistent. Don't just do it for 5 days a week and then binge it out of the weekend, because you're just deleting everything.
Precisely. It's
the consistency is key and vital. Have you seen
And that's why I think, sorry to interrupt, but that's kind of why I think that you should reach for what you can achieve.
Yeah.
You know, don't try and be some superhero with all of this, but do what's within your reach and do it consistently well. It's the consistency is probably more than the actual thing that you change.
Yeah. And that has, we've spoken about before, like such an impact, a good impact on your mental health as well, to feel like you are doing something. And because so much of this is out of our control, when you start to change things that you can control, it really does have a good positive impact on every aspect of the fertility treatment.
And you'll be healthily as well. You'll be, it will improve your general health, which is a good side effect.
So I would argue that any kind of positive lifestyle changes you make, yes, they might not impact your sperm. Say if you do it on a Friday, by Monday, but by Monday you can feel mentally better.
Mm.
You know, that happens quicker. And then once you're in that positive state of mind, it's easier to continue with something that is incredibly stressful. In your experience, have you seen men more open to making these lifestyle changes now? Because even going back, say, 12 years when I started my fertility journey, my mindset was, it's not really going to make any difference. Obviously, my education has changed and I know a lot more now. But do you think men are more open to that now?
I think there's a range and there's a range of responses. I think you'll always get guys who are kind of not willing to do it. But at the other end of the spectrum, I think you've got some guys who are really enthusiastic and might, you know, go too deep and too far into it, which has its own issues. I think there are tensions as well between couples. And one of the big conversations that I have had and still continue to have is when she wants him to do things and he doesn't want to, and that can then lead to trouble in the relationship. A little bit of resentment can creep in, and that then has a knock-on impact on sexual frequency, and that then makes things worse. Now I'm not going to be sufficiently prophetic to say that, you know, all of that is going to change your outcome. But we need to live in healthy relationships. We need to get on with each other, and we need a healthy sex life for both our commitment to each other, but also to increase the chances of having a baby. And if that is some of the thing that falls off and disappears because he's feeling stressed about making all these changes that he doesn't want to do, then that's a negative. So I have spent a lot of time talking to couples about this. And I think women are much cleverer than men in this. And they can change men's lifestyle in ways that men don't even realize that they're changing. And that's kind of the line that I go down for this. You can get what you want without him necessarily knowing, and just be a bit subtle about it rather than being too finger waggy, which is what I think can happen sometimes.
Well, certainly my wife found that in a different aspect, but when it came to talking and opening up about my infertility, she tried that kind of pushy finger waggy because she knew it would help me, and she just wanted me to be better, feel better. But then she soon learned actually the approach to take was more subtly, take your foot off the gas a little bit and just signposting here and there and kind of subliminal messaging. And
but equally, if you know,
good at that.
I don't want to be a gender stereotypist, but you know, if there's a nice meal waiting for you at the end of the day and you didn't prepare it, you're going to eat it.
Yeah.
And that's a way of getting good, healthy food into you. So,
I'm not going to argue with that.
No. Yeah, me neither.
I'm a man of simple pleasures. Feed me and I'm fine.
Precisely.
My wife still does it now. Like if I'm in a bad mood, She'll just make me some food. Yeah. Just sorts everything out.
But that's not to say that men should check out of this whole process. That's just an example of how within a relationship things can take subtle corners and subtle directions.
I think it's joint responsibility, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, in that if if you do find yourself, the fact that it's male factor that's causing the issues, if your partner, your female partner, is still going to take some responsibility of that in terms of changes that she might make in preparation for her injections and things like that. So it is vital. I mean, I've said it before, I'll say it again. I felt firsthand the strain in a relationship. I was lucky enough that we managed to pull ourselves back together and we were stronger afterwards. But you can easily see how, you know, it all uncouples and too much stress, too much strain, and things break. That's why we often say it's really important just to talk. Be really open about how you feel. If your partner does something that you're not totally comfortable with, obviously deliver it in a polite and appropriate manner, but say to him, I'm not quite sure about this. Because I found as a man, I always need to know the why. The why is really important to me. I won't just follow the sheep. I want to know why I'm doing something. And I think that's quite common with men. But if you want me to change something, show me why. And it definitely seems to have had a positive impact for me anyway.
Good. Car conversations are really important as well.
Oh, yeah.
Like the facing the same direction rather than being, talked at. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I was just going to ask, you mentioned when you were speaking to, when you were having that new kind of area built, and you said about the sperm production and where are they? And it was almost like the shock of what men. Like, so have you seen that change throughout the, like with your peers, like that real shift and focus of solely fertility being a female related problem to actually acknowledgement of the kind of well touted 50% of it being men as well?
Yeah, I think things have changed. And, you know, when I haven't worked for the NHS for a few years now, but as I was leaving, they got it. And I was asking for the internet to be opened up, for example, so that men could log on their phones to look at the stuff that they want to look at in private in the room. And finally we got through. But as I tour the world and tour facilities, you know, the amount and the attention to detail with regard to sperm production rooms or just information and resources for men, the VR being an example as well, just shows you that people are thinking. And I think part of that comes through the voice of the patient and the fact that guys are now giving feedback, they're speaking up, we know far more about what's important to them. And I think long may that continue. And every guy's different. And, you know, it's going to be very difficult to please everybody all of the time, in the same way any range of patients are going to be different. But I think the patient voice, guys' voices, are just really important. And I think they're being heard finally in how services are delivered.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, it's good to hear. You know, we obviously get little snippets from people that we talk to, but, you know, you're in a professional in the field seeing it every day, and to hear that it's changing is really positive. Talking about sample rooms, how frequent should a man ejaculate or sustain for before he gives that sample? Because I know there's mixed kind of data out there. It's kind of a bit of a loaded question, I feel, but like, what would you suggest to someone if they asked you that question?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think what I can tell you is that the no answer, the don't do this answer, I think we've got over this one. I'd like to think we have anyway. But I do remember talking to couples years and years ago where they were kind of not, he was not allowed to ejaculate for weeks, you know, 2 weeks before the fertile window. Now, you know, he's going to be all stressed. But then the point is that the sperm that are released are going to be older. And we know that older sperm are not going to function as well as sperm that have just freshly come off the production line. Now, if you scoot forward to the other end, there's actually interesting data showing that if you're ejaculating, you know, once a day, for example, then your sperm quality is much less than somebody that's waited 2 or 3 days. So each man will have his optimal period of abstinence, but it would take far too long to work that out for each individual man. So the general advice, I think, is if you're ejaculating 2 or 3 times a week, preferably during intercourse, then you're going to maximize your sperm health and you're going to maximize the probability of having a baby without any assistance. And I think we should transplant that kind of thinking into the clinic. So if we want a good snapshot of the sperm that are going to be produced next time you ejaculate into your partner, then we need to have a 2 to 3 day abstinence window, which kind of fits that 2 to 3 times a week. Now, doesn't matter if it's 2 days, doesn't really matter if it's 4 days, but it shouldn't be a fortnight and it shouldn't be a day.
Is are men open to talk about that, like in clinics, and obviously, or is it often the female partner that asks that question? Because I distinctly remember being quite embarrassed about asking, you know, basically, how often should I masturbate or have sex with my wife?
Yeah,
it's such a personal thing. And obviously, part of this podcast is breaking down that stigma of it's okay to talk about it. Do you get a lot of guys asking, or is it predominantly like led by the female partners?
It's a mix. I think, you know, there are some partners that want to know the answer, and there's some guys that want to know the answer as well. So I would, I've never really thought about it through that lens, but I'd say it's about a 50, it's probably a 50-50 mix, you know. The very fact we're willing to have that conversation now is really revolutionary. And I can remember years ago asking a guy when he last ejaculated, you know, when he would get really embarrassed the very fact I'd say those words out loud in a sentence. But actually, I get the sense that now men are much more kind of matter of fact about that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, some give you the day and the hour. And, you know, we only want to know roughly. We don't want to know the precise day and hour.
They get out a pen and pad, like with a little journal. And that.
Yeah. Get out their phone and work it out because they recorded it. Yeah. We don't want that.
Definitely a nerves thing involved there. That reminded me of a funny anecdote. I'll try not to deviate too long. But in a previous job, we had to be vetted to a really high level. And during the vetting interview, a colleague of mine was asked what his sexual preference was. And obviously, they were asking about, you know, what gender is his bag. But he then took them through all of his favourite porn categories. And they listened and waited for him to run through it. And he was like, sometimes threesome, sometimes, you know, all the... And they just sat there. And, you know, this is all from him to coming out and telling us. And he said... and then he kind of came to a conclusion. And he went, thanks for that. No, what I meant was, do you like men or women or anything? And he went, oh, shit.
Yeah, too much openness can be a bad thing. Yeah,
anxiety does a lot to a man. So you know, we've talked about the past and kind of the last decade of what's happened. What would you like to see happen in like the future, or what is on the tables? Because you know, male fertility, however you want to put it, is a really hot topic in the fertility world at the moment. Rightly so, it kind of needs to catch up. But what are you looking forward to, or what do you perceive the future looking like?
Well, I think we've come a long way, but I think we've still got a ways to go in terms of the service and the provision and getting men as equal partners. So I think we need to get everybody up to a high level, and that's an education piece within the profession. That's built into medical training. That's built into having the right standards that we all try and work to. And that's ongoing. I think we'll get there eventually. But I also think there's an education piece that we need to do in guys. When I recall my sex ed at school, which was a long time ago, it didn't cover any of this stuff. I'm not sure it covers any of this stuff yet, because the focus generally is on safer sex, stopping teenage pregnancies and that kind of thing. And I get that. I used to run a third year educational module as part of a university course. And I did it for years. And that course, there was an exam at the end of the science. And, you know, that was the whole point of it. But that course became sex ed for university students. The questions that I was asked at the end of every lecture were about precisely the questions that we've been discussing here tonight, which shows me that there's a thirst for knowledge out there and there is an interest. And people often say, well, men aren't interested in this. I think they are. There's a lot of evidence to show that when asked, men have a lot of questions It's just, it isn't being served up to them in an easy, digestible format, which is why this podcast is really good. I think, you know, social media is really good. But we have to kind of get all that mainstream. We need to get the information out before people identify that they've got an issue, so that they're skilled up, so that they can take early action, early testing, early intervention. And I don't think we've got that right yet. Now, if I zoom to the other end of the spectrum, we are limited in what we can do for men medically. Wouldn't it be great to have a pill that a man could take, the GP prescribes, that then means that his sperm production is boosted? That would be just such a great thing to do. I can't see yet in the horizon that that is something that's going to be achievable, but we need to keep working toward it. And then if we think about, for example, some of the stem cell technologies for men with azoospermia, for example, we should, in theory, be able to make sperm for them in the lab in the same way that we can make other cell types for transplantation reasons. And that work is going apace. And I'm hopeful that that might actually come to the fore in the next few years, because it's been done in laboratory animals. It's been done in primates. Somebody has to make a leap of faith at some point and do that for humans. And that hasn't quite worked yet. But the very fact that we're spending lots of time and money and effort on trying to do that, I think is really, really good. So there's a way to go technologically. But at the very basics, there's a way to go from the humanity side in getting the right services and getting the right education in place.
Yeah, really interesting.
I agree, totally agree with the education side of things. I feel like we've talked about this before on the podcast. You know, our generation, me and Sean's generation, are like coping with it. If we can educate the next generation coming along, they can support themselves. Obviously, we'd have to support them as well, but they'd be better prepared. So in schools, because by trade, I am a teacher, the PSHE lessons, it's just a snippet. It's just briefly spoken about. I've done talks in the school that I teach in, and I've never had any of the lads come up and say, I didn't want to know that. It's all been positive, all thankful, all things that they just weren't aware of. Like, there are lads out there that are just waiting for this knowledge. And a proper educational program does need to be put in together. It's possibly, in terms of mental health and support going through fertility, it could be the most powerful resource we've got. You can have counseling, you can have everything, but it actually gives the tools to someone young to know about this. If they are in the position that they find themselves one day in that position, they'll be better. And they'll have better knowledge on how to get the support they need and what's going on, basically. So, education is a big one, a massive one.
The one group of people that I think have got this much better than the mainstream are the cancer charities and the guys who've had cancer treatment. And the reason that I say that is I've spent a lot of time working with the Teenage Cancer Trust and working with young people. Because if you're diagnosed with cancer at age 14, 13, whatever, you suddenly are going to take on a lot of treatments that will affect your future fertility potentially. And so a lot of effort has gone into kind of education and support in people of that age to make sure that they've got the full facts ahead of them so that they can make life choices that are going to make their reproductive futures easier or more informed, should I say. And I've been there, I've spoken to the young people along with other people, and there's a thirst for knowledge. So we know that it's needed. But actually, from the emails and the messages that I've got from guys years later, 10 years after that cancer diagnosis, saying that I remembered everything you said and that piece of advice you gave me has turned out to be great and thank you. And, things have now worked out for me. So, I think we've got a template there. It's just we need to roll that out to everyone in the general population of a young age, rather than just think that it's necessarily a niche thing that only certain groups of young people need.
Yeah. Mm. I think the cancer discussion's really, really important, because when I was young, I wasn't aware that actually it's quite a younger person's disease, like cancer affects the young more than it affects the old. Is that right? And what kind of age could you potentially get testicular cancer? Because obviously guys need to be aware of this, especially the younger ones that might be listening.
Well, cancer gets more common as you get older,
right?
Because you're older, okay? But it's a different type of cancer when you get older.
Right, okay.
And I think what people don't realize is the number of young people that get leukemias, sarcomas, bone cancers, and testicular cancer, for example, in their younger life, where they have to make a really acute choice about what they want to do for the future. You know, they may have to bank sperm at age 14.
Mm.
Now, that's a fertility discussion that might happen in a few days. And the wrong decision at that point could mean that somebody, or a man, never has the opportunity to father a child. So that's why there's so much focus on that. But, you know, the very fact that so many young people have to have that discussion, I think, is invisible to most of us, because unless it's happened to you or it's happened to a family member, you will never, ever consider it. And that's why I think there's a real template there for how those discussions happen. But, you know, we could do it in a less acute, a less stressful kind of way in schools or colleges or university to make sure that people fully understand what is possible and what decisions they might have to make.
We want to tell you about Impril, the unique supplement for conception, which is recommended by fertility specialists for both men and women. We know that good nutrition is really important for fertility, but we are also aware that it's practically impossible to maintain a diet that is perfectly balanced, especially for conception. Choosing the right supplement can be confusing. Many multivitamins contain strong antioxidants, which can actually damage sperm quality. Impril is made from activated micronutrients that help every cell within the human body, from the biggest, the egg, to the smallest, the sperm. These micronutrients have been clinically proven to significantly improve live birth rates for men and women who have previously been struggling to get pregnant. You can find out more and hear from couples who have used Impril by visiting fertilityfamily.co.uk. If you decide this is for you, there's a 10% discount just for our listeners. So make a note of the code MF10. That's MF10.
Mm. That's so interesting and important, to touch upon like the two topics there is like people who are in that sphere kind of are getting that education, that information, and then we talk about education of the general population. And that's something that Kira and I, like you mentioned, we're really passionate about, because we're in this fertility echo chamber and we're trying to break out of it, because Kira and I have both been involved in media pieces that have gone out in like Men's Health magazine, for example. That was great, because that's going to get in the hands of those young lads who are going to the gym, who are interested in that lifestyle, but actually just jolted, putting a little light bulb moment in their mind. And that article, for example, mentioned the fact that fertility rates over sperm counts and quality over the last 50 years are really taking a bit of a hit, and if we keep going on like we are, then the next 50 years don't make a good reading or good prediction. So we're passionate about getting out of this and getting into the ears, the eyes of people who can make those changes when they've got the chance.
Yeah, and I think coming from you guys as well, I mean, I'm at the wrong end of the age group now. I'm kind of getting towards the crumbly end, whereas you guys are still in your prime. And so that's why I think what you do is really, really good, because you're far more relatable to, I think, than somebody of my age now.
Thank you.
We try to be.
We try to be. I feel like you have to have a certain level of experience to kind of be able to talk on the subject, not even just like from me and Sean's perspective, you know, because we are, I mean, Sean's the other side of 40, I'm still under it, but you know, we've had a lot of life experience in those years, and we've taken what we've experienced in our fertility lives and mixed it with everything and kind of come out with who we are. But it enables us to maybe tell our story and project our knowledge a little bit more or better than maybe younger people can. But it's important the youngsters talk as well, because that's vital.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's happening. You know, we do see it. We're often contacted by younger guys asking questions, and it's fantastic to see. It really is. It's the future in terms of the male fertility world does look brighter in terms of it's been taken more seriously and can only get better and better, I feel. That's my personal opinion. I'm going to ask it's a bit of a deep question, this. What happens? I mean, what is going to happen to, like, sperm levels in men? We've seen over the last 50 years, it's decreased drastically. Is it going to keep going that way? This is, like, once again, I feel like this is a bit of a loaded question. But is it going to keep going? Or if we intervene now, can we plateau that out and kind of save it from completely disappearing? Because that's what it feels like to me. In the back of my head, I'm like, what happens if it keeps going down?
Okay, I need to zoom out then. So there is a real debate going on in andrology as to whether that decline is real or not. I would say that the majority of people think it is, but there's a minority of people that think it isn't for all kinds of technical reasons. So I'll declare my hand. I don't think it's real side of the argument for various reasons, probably not the place to go into it. But I think that's where science needs to sort that question out. And it's a bit shameful that we haven't sorted it out. So there are some interesting data sets out there. There's a data set in Denmark, for example, 21 years of looking at the sperm quality of Danish military recruits. And it hasn't changed over the last 21 years. So some would argue that it stopped and it's plateaued. Others would argue it never declined in the first place and it was an overestimate in history. But I think my reading of that is we have stability, at least, I think, for now. And I think it's important not to forget the question. We shouldn't be complacent. There's a lot of concern about some things in the environment, some chemicals that we think are bad for testicles or fertility or for sperm, and we do know that is the case, and we need to do our best to try and regulate those and make sure that we're not exposing current men or future men to those kind of chemicals. So there's, whether you think there's a decline or not, there's a whole piece of work to do to make sure that the environment is as clean as possible, and that needs to happen too. Now, if you want a big evolutionary view, I think evolution and nature is far cleverer than we are, and I think it will solve it. And I don't think we're on a curve to extinction like the dinosaurs. I worry more about climate change and things like that than I worry about sperm decline, because I still think many of the declines are from normal to normal. They're not from normal to abnormal. Too many men have a fertility problem, and that needs looking at. You know, we think that maybe 20% of men have sperm quality lower than it should be, and we need to understand those reasons. But I don't have a mega negative view of the future of humanity, because I think we have ways to solve that. I think we've got the message. I think with the right chemical regulation and a bit more science, we should be able to work that out. And I think nature will help us.
That's amazing. Thank you. Because that's the thing. Like, one of the headlines I've seen said Spermageddon.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the red tops for you, I guess. But, and then to actually have someone like yourself here to say, actually, data, research is perhaps not pointing that way. So, yeah, really super interesting.
It's because my brain also looks at it and thinks, well, maybe we're getting better at doing it. So obviously previous data might not be as relevant as it is now, because we're just doing it that much better. Like you said, we're getting more accurate results now. But no, thank you for asking that question. I can sleep easy tonight.
I think we should, you know, we should monitor this. We need to keep on monitoring it prospectively, and we need to have our wits about us. I think people are doing that. So I sleep comfortably in my bed at night about this question.
I think what's interesting there is what you've talked about, the chemicals and the environmental effects. I think that's definitely just a case with health in general. We're becoming a lot more aware of these things that were used in the 60s, 70s, 80s that weren't regulated, didn't know about. They were just put into things or sprayed on, you know, whatever. And where now there's regulations and other things put in place to check things, we're just becoming more aware of it. So as that will develop, hopefully health in general, around, especially the Western world, will improve, because we are quite accustomed to, how can we put it, wanting it now. So how quick can we get it now? Or we can spray these crops and they'll grow quicker. Or actually what's being sprayed on them. But no, thanks for answering that question, Alan. Really appreciate it. So we, I think it's been a great chat. I would like to get you on, and obviously Sean would as well, to talk a bit more in depth about cancer and cancer treatment and its effects on sperm health at some point. So if you'd like to come back on, we'd be privileged to have you again.
Pleasure. No, that's a big topic in itself. You know, that'll probably take a full episode to go through, but it's a very important topic and it's one that I'm really passionate about. So that will be, that will be a delight to do that.
Definitely. Thank you.
That'd be amazing. Before we do our little final goodbyes, we always ask each guest the same question. And basically it is, what one piece of advice would you give any man that was facing infertility today?
I think it's a fairly simple piece of advice, which is don't ignore it.
Yeah.
You know, early treatment, early diagnosis, early treatment, early intervention will only serve to put you in the best possible place. And I've met many, many guys who've ignored it for far too long. So, you know, take the bull by the horns, if I can use that expression. You know, buy a kit from Xseed, go and see your GP, whatever it is, but don't ignore it.
Amazing advice.
Yeah.
If people wanted to follow you or get contact to you, how could they do that, Alan?
Yeah, I'm on social media, so Alan Pacey on Instagram and X, A-L-L-A-N, two L's in my name.
Amazing. Someone mentioned the other day, did you used to have a social media handle called like Mr. Sperm or something?
I did, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant.
I did, and I once appeared on I had to let it go, but I once appeared on a live television interview for, I think it was Al Jazeera, and the presenter mentioned my Skype username that was at the time Dr. Sperm, and instantly it was bang, ping, 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 ping as people were trying to reach me. So, yeah, no, brilliant. That one doesn't work anymore. Alan Pacey, just my name.
Awesome.
It's a great name, though, that Mr. Sperm, Dr. Yeah, Sperm.
Dr. Sperm.
At least straight to the point.
It is. I was younger then.
We look forward to having you on again soon.
It'd be a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favour and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.